In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I talk about growing from 1K to 5K of MRR, projecting SaaS revenue growth, refining your sales process, and more listener questions. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 343. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products. Whether you built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So where this week, sir?
Well, I'm hoping that in another week or two, I'll have my completed self-sign-up process in place. And it's been rather painful to kind of rework those pieces of the code just because it's, you know, it's core to like somebody signing up. So it has to work properly. And I've found places where like if the sign-up process previously had failed at some point along the way, it left a bunch of orphan data. And I'm like, oh, God. And then it had to, you know, like you start over and then it leaves all this things in the database. I'm just like, all right, so I got to start refactoring some of that stuff. And the cleanup is kind of a pain in the neck, but you know, things are progressing pretty well at this point. I'm hoping to have that cleaned off my plate in the next week or two.
Yeah, that's nice. You know, one thing that we do for, you know, we have a two-step sign-up process for trial. And if they do the first step, but don't enter their credit card, we cookie them. And if they come back, we just present them with a credit card. You know, we don't make them do the first step again.
Yeah, that's sort of what I'm looking for right now. But I'm kind of looking for ways to like create the account and have it as like a placeholder without also creating a subscription inside the system. So that's the part that's kind of hanging me up a little bit, is trying to figure out exactly how to do that. The cookie idea is interesting, but at the same time, like I don't necessarily want to leave their credentials sitting there on, you know, in a cookie someplace either.
Oh yeah, no, we store it in the database and then cookie them with you know, with an account ID, right? Or at least a user ID. Yeah, we wouldn't store that in a cookie. But it's just an idea. It's a nice elegant way. Some people will come back and be like, "I can't believe it. I was, you know, I didn't have to enter my stuff again to get in." So, it can be a nice perk for it's like a usability thing for people who get stuck in the middle with the credit card and then come back a few hours later and it's already there at the credit card screen.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I'm looking for and looking to try and get around, because like I said, the data structures don't really support that just yet. So
no, got it. That's a bummer. For me, you probably hear I'm sick this week. I've been working, but I just kind of feel hazy and like everything's just taking longer to get done. So I hate being sick a lot because I feel like I have a bunch of work to do. You know, I got things to do. I don't have time. Who's got time to be sick these days?
Yeah, my son was sick this past week, so he was out for like 1 or 2 days of school.
That's crazy. Yeah, we went to California last weekend for Memorial Day, and pretty much my whole family got some type. It was just a head cold. We all got it, and I don't know. We like had it within the first day we were there, so I feel like we caught it before we left. You know, I don't think you catch it on the plane, and then the next day you wake up. I think there's a longer incubation period for most colds, so the timing was kind of bizarre, but it seems to be hitting each of us in its own way right now. So, but the show must go on, am I right?
I guess.
Every week,
yes.
Every Tuesday morning, we get this podcast out, so apologies in advance if my voice kind of grates on people. I am heavily using the mute button to cough while you're talking right now.
So what are we talking about this week?
Well, we have a nice backlog of listener questions once again, and so I wanted to run through some of those. Actually, there's a couple that really aren't questions. They're just kind of comments and accolades for us. And this first one is a voicemail about growing from 1K to 5K of MRR.
Hey, Rob and Mike, Brian Fleming from Detroit City here. I just wanted to call and say thank you so much for the podcast you guys put out. You know, being here in Detroit, you just don't talk to anybody who's doing this SaaS stuff, and it is so goddamn hard. I'll tell you what, guys, a year ago, I was listening to your podcast, struggling along my SaaS business, doing about $1,000 a month, and I listened to an episode where you guys we're talking about how to know if your business is viable and sketching out your lifetime customer value on a napkin. And I did that, and it's like a light bulb went off. I moved to a yearly rebill. I increased my prices. And here I am a year later. My business went from $1,000 a month to $5,000 a month. I know you guys have seen ones that have grown better, but I'm pretty proud of it. And again, it's all from listening to your guys' episode. That was one in particular. Appreciate everything you guys do. Like I said, you're the first one I go to on my podcast. Really look forward to it every week. Keep up the great work, guys. And when I do have a question, I'm going to call back in and hit you up on it. Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, that's great to hear. I mean, it's always nice to hear from listeners who listen to an episode and are then are able to act on that advice or the commentary that we give and be able to take things to the next level and really move their businesses forward. So really appreciate hearing that from you, Ryan.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, that's really why we do it. And the fact that anyone ever gets value out of anything you or I say, Mike, is just a dang miracle at this point. So our next question is about how to project revenue growth. And it's from friend of the show, Craig Hewitt. He's the founder of Podcast Motor at podcastmotor.com. And he says, hey guys, after launching my first SaaS product last week, I'm wondering what realistic ranges for growth scaling are. Heard Mike talking about doubling blue tick revenue from 1 to 2K in a month. On the last episode. Seems like a great goal, but is that kind of expectation realistic? And does the same growth curve slope apply at scale? For instance, did Drip see 100% growth months after you were doing mid five digits a month? Be interested to hear your thoughts.
So for mine, I looked back over the revenue numbers for Bluetick after I started officially selling it to people. And there were a couple of months where I did 100% month over month growth, but it was not common. So like I would get 100% one month and then I would double it. And then the month after that, I'd get like 50% or it would just stay even in terms of growth. So like there's this exponential curve that you end up getting. And depending on which numbers you're specifically looking at, whether it is growth from one month to the next versus your total size, those are two entirely different things. What I was looking to do was originally I was saying, okay, I want to go from 1,000 to 2,000. But even a couple of days later, I looked at that and said, you know what, that's actually not very realistic, because in my mind, I was like, oh, I'll be doubling my customer base. But the reality is that like doubling the customer base is not realistic because it took me X months to get there. What would be more realistic is if I were to say, look, I want to double the number of customers that I got last month, because that jump is probably too large. If it takes you 4 months to get to 20 customers, you're probably not going to be able to add 20 customers in the next month, barring some major marketing strategy that you do or like a big launch or something like that. And that's not what I had planned. So I realized a couple of days later that that was not going to be a realistic goal. If you look at things like Paul Graham has some advice about the growth rates for Y Combinator startups, and they're looking for 5 to 7% growth per week. And he says, if you can hit 10% a week, you're doing exceptionally well. And if you can only manage 1%, it's a sign you haven't yet figured out what you're doing. In the early days, I think it's a lot easier to get those higher percentage growth numbers, just because adding one person, if you've got 10, and that's a 10% growth rate. But once you get to 100, adding one is only 1%. So again, like you have to look at both the total size that you're trying to grow, and then kind of backtrack a little bit and look to see like how long it has taken you to get there in order to be able to start projecting forward and establish more realistic goals.
Yeah, there's kind of early stage growth where you're just scrapping, for every individual customer. And it can be a little harder to project at that point. But if you have a nice source of folks that you can bring in almost by hand, you know, where you have that 300 person launch list or something, and you're kind of individually choosing people out of that, then you can kind of get a feel for how many you can logically bring in a month. Once you're past that, you know, once you've, let's say you've launched and you start marketing, and you know, you have content marketing, you have Facebook ads, you have SEO, you just have all the channels, you'll start to see that the numbers just pan out, right? It's like, depending on the number of unique visitors you get to your site, what percent, you know, convert to trial or to customer or whatever. And you can just look at those numbers, and that will allow you to start projecting out a month, 2 months, 3 months, and then you'll be able to see which levers you need to pull in order to increase that. So this is where it becomes easier to project, but harder to make a dent, right? Because adding 1, 2, 3 customers doesn't make a dent when you're growing 5K a month MRR. Now, to really dig in on Craig's question, you know, he's asking, can you have 100% growth once you're already doing, you know, 50K a month or whatever? And the answer is not typically, right? That's not really a sustainable growth pattern. Don't think of it in terms of percentages. Think of it in terms of flat dollar amounts. In the early days, I would shoot for like, if you can get into 4 figures of monthly MRR growth, you're doing okay. And I mean, early days is like sub 10 or sub 15K of monthly recurring revenue, right? So if you can grow at 1 or 2K a month during that time, I don't think of it as a percentage. I just think of it as getting to 1 or 2K. And if you can get to that and make it sustainable so that it's, you know, a flywheel in essence that grows at 1 to 2K a month, that's a pretty decent start. And if you look out a year, then you think, wow, I'm going to have grown 12 to 24K MRR. And then what you do is you look at, how do I now get to 4 or 5K MRR? And then how do I get to 10K MRR growth? And the sooner you can get there, your growth will be huge at first, right? So let's say you get to 20K MRR and you're growing at 5K a month. Well, man, you have a 25% growth rate. But then next month, you're going to have like a 22% growth rate. And then the month after, if your growth stays flat, you're going to be at an 18%. And it's going to get smaller each month. But if you're still growing at 5K MRR, that's actually a pretty damn good bootstrap business. You know, the percentages start having less of an impact at that point, or I should say less meaning, because if you're continue to grow at 5K MRR every month, that's a good business. Now, at a certain point, your churn will make it so that your 5K MRR growth will get smaller and smaller over time. That's really a whole separate conversation. That's when you hit a plateau. And there was an episode we recorded probably 100 episodes ago with Ruben Gomez about how to see plateaus coming and how to get over them. But I guess what I'd encourage you to do, Craig, when you're thinking about this, is think about it in terms of absolute dollar amount. And really, people say percentages because A, it sounds impressive, or B, they want to kind of not give absolute revenue numbers in public, right? So when I used to talk about Drip's revenue growth on the podcast, I didn't want to say we're growing at 5K or 10K a month. So I used a percentage instead. But realistically, the absolute dollar amount, especially for a bootstrapper, in my opinion, is what counts, because that allows you, you know, that dollar amount is what allows you to hire people, is what allows you to buy Facebook ads, it's what allows you to run the business, whereas percentages really have just such, you know, a smaller meaning. So, you know, you do hear about Y Combinator startups or even some bootstrap startups that get really good traction. And yeah, growing 20 to 40% a month for a while is totally doable. It's hard work and you really need to catch a flyer. You know, it's a Cinderella situation, but it is possible, you know, for the time being. But growing 100% month over month for more than just a few months is unheard of. I mean, I think you would literally need to be like an Uber or something to be seeing growth like that. So I hope that helps, Craig. Thanks for the question. Our next question is from Chris Van Beek from VendorRegistry.com. And he says, I've been thoroughly enjoying your new podcast and I heard you were looking for some questions. Vendor Registry's SaaS platform and marketplace streamlines the $250 billion local government purchasing market by standardizing and centralizing traditionally paper-intensive workflows. Since we have so much greenfield ahead of us, coming up with new ideas takes only 10% of our time. The other 90% is spent debating which ideas to execute first. Ideally, we stop debating and we let the market decide through A/B testing. However, implementing A/B testing requires money for the tools, dev time to build out two versions of everything, and enough users to generate actionable data, all of which are in short supply. How do you recommend we get started with A/B testing given resource constraints?
I think the resource constraints that you mentioned are probably the place to start, because you've talked about how there's a couple of different places where you have these resource constraints. There's time, there's money, and then there's the low numbers of users. And I think the low number of users is the thing to really focus on, just because it's really difficult to do A/B testing if you don't have, you know, like a large number of people that you can put through a particular part of your sales funnel and get the results that you need in a short enough time span. If you're running an A/B test and it takes you 12 months to get a result, there's two problems with that. The first one is that it takes you 12 months to iterate and do any sort of testing to move you to the next level. The second part of that is that because it's such a large time span, those results are probably not really statistically relevant anyway. Even if you go through those calculations and you think to yourself, oh, well, yeah, this is statistically relevant, it's probably not, just because of the seasonality of that stuff. You know, it may be statistical over the course of another year, but it's not helpful. That's the root problem, is it's just not helpful for your business to figure out really what's going on. So I would not really look at A/B testing at all. I would probably look at other areas of your business and try and find places where you can really drive the business forward, you know, whether that's content marketing or advertising. You know, you could try various different advertising channels. You could try face-to-face meetings. For this particular industry, it seems to me like it's very much relationship-driven. And yes, there's certain, you know, lists and stuff that you can get on, but having relationships with people who can recommend your services, that's really what tends to drive business in like a large enterprise environment, which is kind of what the vendor registry falls under.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much I have to add to that, other than it doesn't sound like split testing is the way to go for you. You just need a lot of traffic to do it, and it does take a lot of time. It's easier to split test things like headlines, pricing page. I would not build out two versions of anything. I think this is much more about talking to customers, potential customers, and getting a small sample size, but getting like real feedback. So whether that's in person at conferences or trade shows or Skype calls or emails or, you know, whatever it takes, that's going to be a faster and a more effective way to try to figure out what to build next. This is the conundrum of being a good product person, is figuring out what to build next. And I think there's a big element that's your vision of what it should do. It's a big part of gut feeling based on your kind of your experience in the space and, you know, the competitive landscape. And then part of that, and in my opinion, it should not be the overriding part, is talking to customers and getting ideas and getting a sense of where the market wants you to head. I don't think split testing is the way to go. You know, you think about how we decide on what's the next feature to build in Drip. We don't build two different features and split test them. We make the decision, you know, and it's based on a bunch of factors that we kind of combine and have honed over the past several years. So thanks for the question. I hope that was helpful. Our next question is from a listener who asked to remain anonymous. And he says, he's been following the podcast for a few years, can't get enough of it. He's self-funded a B2B SaaS startup for about 2 years. He says, I have dozens of potential customer interviews and have been quite involved in helping beta users and testing the product myself. It touches on a sensitive business process that impacts other processes. So potential customers want a certain level of configuration and they are very afraid of bugs. I've had a few bad experiences with some beta users who keep asking for improvements and never sign up for the product. And to be fair, the app has had some bugs here and there as we were in a hurry to push new features. So we may have gone too far in the opposite direction, asking customers to sign a statement of work contract before doing any implementation. And it is really slowing the intake of new customers, even if they are enthusiastic after we show them the demo. Now that we can slow down on new features, I'm hesitating on the priority to pursue. I have a number of things we're looking at. Do you think we should remove any barriers from the sales process for the time being, focus on removing all bugs, and send the message that the app will have to be used mostly as is? Or do you think we should make screencasts, write tutorials, etc., to let users start on their own? I'm hesitant to do this because based on their objectives and on their existing processes, they will have to use the app in different ways. For what it's worth, the cheapest pricing tier is $300 a month and the medium tier is $900 a month. What do you think, Mike? And frankly, I don't think we need to stay within his, you know, he said, should I do this or that? I'm not sure that either of those is the right choice. So I don't think we need to stay within kind of the boundaries he's laid out.
I think this is an interesting question. The problem here is I think that you're unsure of how to proceed. And it partly depends on where your revenue is. And I think at those price points, you're probably at a point where, you know, if you've been working on it for a couple of years, my guess is that it's probably profitable. And I think that given that, you probably want to put yourself in a position where the app is making enough money that you can pour additional money from the business back into it and reinvest those profits to build not just the business, but also go back and address some of the quality issues or the bugs and stuff that are in there. And that's just going to take more resources, more engineering time. And to get that stuff, you need money. So I would probably focus on anything that is going to be bringing in revenue. And it doesn't seem to me like that's doing screencasts and tutorials. Those are things that are helpful for users, but they're not necessary to like get somebody in the door and in as a paying customer. You can deal with a lot of issues like that that come up on an ad hoc basis or during onboarding sessions. There's ways to get around that without actually having to do the work. And then basically do whatever needs to be done in order to drive those sales through. If people need personal demos or handholding during a personal walkthrough or something like that, you can use those as well. You know, at the price points, my guess is you're probably talking to people directly for most of your sales, especially if you're going to do any sort of annual contract or anything like that. So those are the places where I would focus. And then once you have that money coming in the door, then turn around and start deciding where that money should be allocated to help build the product in the right direction. For people who are coming in, I think the interesting piece about that was that flip-flopping back and forth between, oh, there's some bugs, we should get them taken care of, versus going to the other extreme because people aren't actually signing up for it after you go in and address the issues that they brought up. What I've been doing is telling people, look, if you sign up, then I will look at that as kind of a higher priority. So I typically track feature requests during a demo, and I'll write down somebody's name or tag it on a bug, you know, like an open case inside my bug tracker, and say, put the person's name on it. But if they don't sign up, automatically it becomes a lower priority to me because it's not a paying customer. They didn't sign up for it. But if I get enough of those onto a particular case, then I can probably justify spending time and effort because then it looks to me like it's impacting sales. And it doesn't sound like you are tracking any of that information yet right now. You're really just micro-focused at the individual person who you're looking to onboard. I would back off from that a little bit and try and take more of a macro view to it and say, is this a big enough problem that we should deal with it? Or is it something that we can just log and come back to it in the future?
Yeah, my sense is it sounds like you have a couple issues. If you have bugs in the app right now, I mean, that's kind of the first thing you need to take care of. And I would kind of put the brakes on everything and fix those. Because if you get a reputation in the space, and it sounds like it might even be a small space where people know each other and are talking, if you get the reputation of being buggy, that doesn't go away. It's, you know, it's like your credit score. Like once you jack that score, it is really, really hard, if not impossible, to get that back. So that would be the first priority of all this stuff that I would basically buckle down. It's kind of like having performance problems, right? It's like we halt almost all feature development if we find that we're running into performance problems, because you just can't let that stuff go. It's only going to get worse, and it's going to tarnish your reputation. After that, or as that's in process, it sounds like you've had folks who ask for improvements and never sign up. And by improvements, you know, if you just mean bug fixes, then that's fine. I would do that. But if they're asking for more features, something that I would do in the early days early days of Drip is, if someone asked for a feature, I would say, is this the one thing that you need us to implement to be able to use Drip? And if they said yes, then I said, great, sign up for a trial and we will have this implemented by the time your trial expires. And if we don't, I will comp your months, like I will comp your account until this feature is built. Now, we don't do that anymore, right? Tens of thousands of users, you can't. But in the early days when we were scrappy, that's the kind of stuff I was doing to try to get, you know, if someone had a list of 10,000 or 15,000 people, it's going to pay us a couple hundred bucks a month. That was a big deal. And it sounds like for you, it's totally worth doing. So it's interesting. I don't know about a statement of work contract or any of that stuff. That to me feels a little cumbersome and like a lot of overhead, but just having them sign up, put a credit card on file is a step. And you'll find that some people will balk and they don't sign up, and that's fine. They were never going to sign up, you know, and the ones who do are committed to it, and then you implement their features. And I just found that that's a good way to do it. Given your price point, personally, unless you have a lot of inbound interest, I would personally be handholding and doing very much one-on-one sales. The fact that, you know, between 300 and 900, and I'm assuming you have a higher end tier, so your you know, monthly average revenue per user is going to be in the, let's just say, $400-$600 range. That's a nice chunk of change, and that is definitely worth your time or someone you hire's time to handhold folks and get them started. I would not tend to go towards the self onboarding at this point, just because of the price point and the value that I think that, you know, the value that the customers bring to your business is worth the time to spend, especially in these early days, to do the learning and to handhold everybody into the app. So I hope that helps. Our next question is actually not a question. It's a compliment for us and the podcast. It's from Alex Summerfield. And he says, hey guys, I've been listening to the podcast for about 3 years. And I remember when I first listened to the episodes and the just thinking about it part of your intro really fit for me. I tried a couple of ideas, but they never took off. After switching a couple jobs and getting too busy to work on side projects, I finally got sick of my job and started consulting and working on a startup on the side. I listened to your latest episode and heard the just thinking about it part. And it finally hit me that I'm no longer just thinking about it. I'm actually doing it. I just wanted to say thank you for the impact you've had on my life. All the advice has helped. And I really enjoy hearing the updates on your businesses.
Thanks for the compliment, Alex. I do think that it's really hard to get started. And I think a lot of it has to do with the barriers that we kind of encounter as we're growing up in the social environments that we either come out of or are immersed in on a daily basis. I mean, breaking away from the things that the people around you are doing is just really challenging, to be honest. And if you don't interact with people who are starting their own businesses or entrepreneurs or even doing software on their own, it can be very difficult to kind of break the mold, and people look at you funny and say, you know, what is it that you're doing? Because you're the oddball at that point. You're weird. So it's nice to hear from someone like you who's gone out there and actually started working on side products with the, you know, intent to move forward and start your own thing.
Couple more questions. Our next one is from Rob. And he says, I'm part of an early stage bootstrap startup company in the UK with two other co-founders. We are between 3 and 6 months from launching a product and having any revenue. One of my co-founders is pushing for job titles / corporate roles to be assigned, like CEO, CTO, etc. Is it important to allocate corporate titles / roles? Is it best to get this sorted early in the life of a company, or is it just a distraction? And, you know, Mike, as you think through this, I think corporate titles versus corporate roles is two totally different questions. So maybe we can tackle each of those individually.
Yeah, I was going to mention that because like when you're doing customer development, it seems to me like CEO and CTO, when you're talking to a prospective customer, you may think that that sounds impressive, but for the most part, especially if you're early on, you don't even have a product yet, those titles, I feel like they detract from whatever it is that you're trying to do because they say, oh, you're the CEO of this company that really has nothing and you're asking people for help versus if you are the CEO of a company that has a full-blown product and it's been in the market for 3 or 4 years, like that has weight behind it. That early on, I would just say founder, or co-founder. I wouldn't even worry about those corporate titles when you're talking to customers or prospective customers. They're basically meaningless at that point. In terms of roles, though, like that's what people tend to think about when they think of titles, like, oh, the CEO does this, the CTO does this. And really, like internally, that's where that matters, but externally, it doesn't. So you want to have a clear expectations of each other and what it is that you're expected to do inside of the business. And then externally to your clients and customers, I would just say you're a founder or co-founder. Like I wouldn't go into like what it is that your actual title is because it really doesn't matter. But internally, you do need to be clear on what is your responsibility versus what your co-founder's responsibility is so that each of you know what they're supposed to be working on and when they should be getting guidance and input from the other person into the things that they're doing.
Yeah, I don't have much to add to that. I think that's a very good kind of summation of it. There's certain things that are distractions. Yeah, and I found that using the phrase co-founder is really helpful, especially in the early days when folks know that you're still being scrappy and doing customer development. All right, last question for the day is about sending promotional emails to existing customers. It comes from Bruce Pomeroy, and he says, thanks for the great show. I have a simple software product I've been selling online for several years. My customers all need to provide their email addresses so I can send them their payment confirmation and so I can authenticate them when they log in to use my product. I don't state on my signup page anything about what types of communications the new customer should expect to receive from me when they provide their email. I'm releasing some improvements and new features. Some of these improvements will benefit existing customers with no additional payment, and some new features I intend to sell to existing customers as add-ons. Is it okay to email my customers to tell them about the new features? They haven't given explicit consent to receive email from me. I notice that whenever I sign up for SaaS products, I receive a lot of emails from SaaS providers, even though I don't recall opting into any mailing list. So do you guys think it's ethical, legal, or wise to send emails to my existing customers? Would you recommend I add an opt-in checkbox or some small print stating that customers can expect to receive occasional information / promotional emails and only send email to customers who opt in or have had a chance to read the small print? Thanks in advance for your advice on this. And his app is called countingdown2.com. That's countingdown2.com. So there's definitely, I like the way he phrases it. You know, there's legal implications and then there's ethical. That seems a little strong, but you know, kind of your own moral compass is how it feels. What are your thoughts on this, Mike?
Well, I think we have to provide the standard podcast disclaimer that we're not lawyers and you can't rely on us for legal advice, especially given that this business is based in Canada. So like laws there are different than they are here in the US. So given that, my thoughts on this are that if somebody is signing up for your SaaS product, there's a couple of different types of emails that you could send to them. When they purchase it and if you send them a receipt, that's what's considered to be a transactional email. They purchase something from you, you send them a receipt, that's completely legit. Like you are almost expected to send that email, and that does not fall under any sort of spam laws that I'm aware of. When you get past that and you start talking about newsletters and product updates and things like that, that's where it gets into the gray area, which I think that you're a little concerned about. If you're running a SaaS, it seems to me like you almost have to have people on a newsletter of some kind or a product updates email list of some kind. That said, I would default to adding them to it, but I would explicitly give them the ability to opt out at any time. Even if they are an ongoing customer, you might want to segment that list a little bit to say, you know, give them a profile page that says, only email me about product updates and include me in my newsletter as two different options. And then you segment your list based on those two things. That way, if somebody wants completely out and they only want the receipts from you, you can still send those email receipts to them. But if they also want to receive your newsletter and the product updates, you're still going to be sending those to them. Again, just segmenting between those two types of people, or if there's other segments that you want to include in that, I would do that, but I would opt them in by default and then let them choose otherwise if they want to. You know, that's probably the way that I would approach it for that. But again, I mean, there's obviously like legal implications as well. And as to what Rob said about like the moral moral implications of it regarding your moral compass. If you sign up for a SaaS, like you kind of expect to get emailed and told like, hey, this is how this product can provide additional value. And I think what you're probably seeing is when you sign up for a new product, people are sending you like a lot of onboarding emails. And I think that those fall into that gray, fuzzy area where like a SaaS vendor could easily overwhelm you with a lot of email to the point that you start to consider it spam more than anything else, especially if you decided to not use the product. And there's a difference between those emails that are being sent as onboarding emails where you don't have the opportunity to opt out, because some vendors will send those and you can't opt out. Like that's part of their onboarding process. So depending on whether you allow them to opt out or not, that factors into it.
Yeah. In the US, CAN-SPAM says if you have a, you know, a commerce relationship or a customer relationship with someone that you can send emails to them, you know, related to the business, transactional, and I think otherwise. There's always this gray area, right? It's like if you read the verbiage exactly, you could interpret it one way or the other. But in general, you do see SaaS apps, if you sign up, they don't explicitly make you opt in and they send email and people are not being investigated by what FTC or FCC or whoever would investigate that. So I think the precedent is that this is generally considered a legal thing. Like Mike said, your moral compass is going to vary. There are people who will say, oh, I should explicitly opt in for every single email you're going to send me. I mean, people get so far into the protection of your email address and your inbox and that no one should ever email you. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there are spammers, right? And so you got to ask yourself, you know, what's it worth here? There's some business value to you. People genuinely do generally really want to hear about feature updates. I mean, specifically feature updates to the app. Absolutely. I mean, who kind of doesn't want to hear that? It's pretty rare that people unsubscribe. Like Mike said, you should give them the opportunity to do that. And even if you're sending things that are upsells, my guess is that's going to be pretty valuable information for people, because if it's an upsell, it's likely going to have some value that a good chunk of your list is going to at least be interested in and interested in hearing about. So, I mean, everything you've mentioned in terms of the content, it's not like suddenly you're taking customers and just starting sending them random blog posts with some content in it, right? I mean, these are really applicable to kind of the what they've signed up for, right? And what they're paying you money for. And so I don't personally have any kind of issue with you doing that. It sounds like you're not going to be overly promotional based on how careful you're even, you know, thinking about this, which some people don't do. So anyways, that's kind of my take on it as well. It sounds like Mike and I are pretty much in line on this. And I think that's the general consensus of kind of the industry and where it's at today.
Yeah, I mean, coincidentally, like it's the first that we're recording on, and I'm getting ready to send out an email to the people who are current subscribers for Bluetick to tell them, like, here's a list of all the different updates that have been added over the past 4 to 6 weeks that, you know, you might be interested in hearing about, or maybe you didn't know about this feature, or this was something that was requested by a couple of people, just to let them know, because there's a difference between features that a specific person requested, and you can let them know when those things go in, but you still have to let the rest of the customers know that that new feature has been added. Otherwise, they won't know anything about it. I mean, I've seen a couple of support requests come in and say, hey, is it possible for us to be able to do this? And I'm like, yep, I actually just added it a week ago and I haven't gotten around to sending out basically the product updates over the past month. So I do think that it's a good practice to get into to be sending those out, especially if you're running a SaaS where it's regularly changing and the expectations of the customers are that over time that SaaS app is going to get better. And that matters a lot more, I think, in the early stages than when you've got a late stage SaaS where it's like you're not really adding a lot of features, you're adding scalability and things like that. But if you're adding features at a very fast pace, it's probably best to like email them on a monthly basis to say, hey, here's all the new things that are going in that you're getting essentially for free just for being a paying customer. And with that, I think it wraps us up for the day. If you have a question for us, feel free to call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupstherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupstherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.